Okay. Well, while he's looking to that, I'll just speak a little more loudly. Used to doing that. A lot of times when I'm in Peru, I've been going to Peru since about 2003. There's very little technology there. But I usually don't have to speak this far to the back. My name's Kevin O'Banion, and I was raised in the Houston area. We raised our boys in Stephenville, married my wife Lori in San Marcos, Texas. We then moved to Burnet, where I had the privilege of working with a couple of really fine men, Robert Turner and Dan Shipley. Worked with them for a couple of years. Then moved to Stephenville, and that's where we were for 20 years. I taught biology at Tarleton State University and did the dual credit and AP courses at the high school as well. That was a lot of fun. So instead of making tents, I made tests for many years. Then had an opportunity to move to Abilene. So we moved to Abilene. We were there at the Wiley Church for 7 years. And then the opportunity to move to Kings Ridge. Kings Ridge had been helping me go to Peru for several years. And so that opportunity opened up. And so we are now at Kings Ridge there in Lubbock. But I thank you for your invitation to come and speak with you this evening. I prefer a teaching format, but the challenge of that is when you're with a congregation that they're not used to you, you don't know their names, there's a little bit of a reluctance to raise your hand, to speak up, to ask a question, but feel free to do that. I taught in classes with 250 kids. I didn't learn their names in one semester. But, I like that kind of back and forth format. So if you have a question, comment, feel free to raise your hand and make that. Don't know if you'll take me up on that offer, but at least you've been invited to do that. I also like when we're talking about especially some of the prophets, the Old Testament books, I like to give a little bit of background to that, try to fill in some of the blanks as far as history is concerned. And so when we get to the book of Daniel, there are several major world empires that had an impact. Daniel was familiar with at least three of those. When he was a child, grew up under one empire, then saw a change to the next empire, and then in the latter part of his life saw a change in the third, into a third empire. Now, the empire that Daniel is dealing with, who's ruling during Daniel's day and the book of Daniel? What's the major empire in the book of Daniel? The Babylonian Empire, that's right, the Babylonian Empire. Babylon had been around for a very long time. The Babylonian civilization had started, they estimate, somewhere around 2000 B.C. And back at that time, Babylon had been a dominating world power. But then she kind of waned in her strength. And so she regained strength, though, after the Assyrians had come in. And that's really another world power that we're going to be dealing with is the Assyrian Empire. That was one of the first major world empires. And this gives you an idea of about the extent of the Assyrian Empire. Sargon II was actually the Assyrian ruler who had an impact on the Bible story. Because you probably recall that there was a split in the kingdom of Israel. 10 of the tribes rebelled, became known as Israel in the north. 2 of the tribes remained faithful to the son of Solomon, whose name was Rehoboam. And so they became known as Judah. Well, both the north and the south had more than their share of difficulties and rebellion against God. The north especially instituted idolatry right away. Jeroboam put in the golden calves at Dan and Bethel and was afraid that the people would be going back down south to Jerusalem. Well, eventually things got so bad, and they were warned by the prophets that they needed to repent, they needed to go back to God. If they didn't do this, then they would be carried away into captivity. And it was the Assyrians under Sargon II that actually carried the Israelites away into Assyrian captivity, those northern 10 tribes. And this is just a relief of Sargon II and a visiting dignitary from that particular era. Here's another statue that they located in the palace of Sargon II. So you get an idea of some of the look of the Assyrians. The Babylonians looked very similar as well. Well, during this time that Sargon II was conquering the north, and what was the capital of the northern tribes? Samaria, that's right, Samaria. Well, when he conquered Samaria, he also went a little bit further down, and he was actually pursuing the Egyptians while he was doing this. But during that time then, another power began to arise under a ruler by the name of Nabopolassar. And he declared independence from Assyria. And eventually, he would conquer and defeat the main capital of the Assyrians, which was at Nineveh. And so he defeated the Assyrians. Eventually, they formed, the Assyrians formed an ally with the Egyptians and Pharaoh Necho. He's another person you remember from your Old Testament history. Pharaoh Necho tried to come to the aid of the Assyrians. They didn't want the Babylonians gaining power. And on his way through Judah, one of the kings tried to stop him. Do you remember who tried to stop Pharaoh Necho and was killed in the battle? And he was a good king. Josiah, good King Josiah, right, was killed when he tried to stop. And God actually gave a reason for allowing Josiah's death. It was to spare him from having to witness what was to come and the destruction and the punishment that God was going to send against the south as well, the two tribes that had become wicked and idolatrous as well. Well, God utilized the son of Nabopolassar to do a lot of his work. Who was Nabopolassar's son that became really the king over the Babylonians during their golden era? Nebuchadnezzar, that's right. That was Nebuchadnezzar. And so Nebuchadnezzar, he defeated the rest of the Egyptian army along with the Assyrians, basically crushed them, just establishing the dominance of the Babylonian Empire. Now, while he was down pursuing the Egyptians, and he would have been in this area right here, he was pursuing them down back to Egypt, he got word that his dad back in Babylon had died. So Nebuchadnezzar leaves here, but before he left, he took some captives. And this was actually the first wave of captives that were carried away to Babylon. That was in 606, approximately 606 BC. And who was among that first wave of captives? Daniel, that's right. And then his three friends, who were later renamed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so they were in that first wave of captives there in 606 BC that was carried over to Babylon, carried over to the capital city of Babylon. There you can read in Daniel chapter 1 that they received some training to serve in the royal court. They were instructed in the language, in the science, in the knowledge of the Chaldeans. Now, who are the Chaldeans? The Babylonians, that's right. That's just another name for the Babylonians. The land of Babylon was also known as the land of Shinar. And you actually see the beginning of Shinar and Babylon. Nimrod was the one that established that particular city back in Genesis chapter 10. You can read that in verses 8 through 10, where he established. And then eventually there would be a very famous tower that would be erected right there at Babylon. And what tower was that in Genesis chapter 11? The Tower of Babel. That's right. That was most likely erected somewhere in that area around Babylon. In fact, a lot of archaeologists believe that the Temple of Marduk, and we'll see why, was built on top of the ruins of the Tower of Babel, or Babel as some pronounce it. But this gives us a little bit of background. That first wave in 606 with Daniel were taken from Jerusalem and carried back. Now, why am I doing this? Why am I going up and down? Yeah, you didn't go this way. Why didn't you go this way? Arabian desert. You couldn't travel. So if you've heard of the Fertile Crescent, this is the Fertile Crescent right there. Kind of crescent shape. That's where the water was. That's where the rivers were. You had to follow the water and follow where there would be food sources as well. So that's why they would go that direction back to Babylon. Now, Nebuchadnezzar went back down and got another wave of Jews in 597 B.C. Now, with that wave of Jews, another prophet was taken. Which prophet was taken in that second wave in 597? He was contemporary with Daniel. Ezekiel. That's right. Ezekiel was taken. So actually, you've got three prophets that are going on right now. You've got who's left in Jerusalem? You know the weeping prophet. He's going to witness the destruction of Jerusalem. Jeremiah is here in Jerusalem. Daniel is going to be doing his work with the kings, and possibly one of the purposes in Daniel remaining there in Babylon was to influence these kings and to speak for God to these kings, to let them know that you were given these empires because God has willed this. God's the one that's placed you in this position. It's not yourself that did this. And so Daniel was the one that reminded successive kings that, you know, they were there by the will of God. And not because of their own ingenuity and their own strength were they the kings. So we've got Daniel up here. And then a little bit further south, somewhere right in here, he was along the river Kibar in a place called Tel Aviv. They think it's near another place called Nippur, which they don't know where either one of those are. But they're thinking that it was approximately somewhere in this area between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. And so Ezekiel was most likely carried to that spot. And so he would have been in that region. And his message was to those 10,000 Jews and that settlement of Jews to try to prepare them for the destruction of Jerusalem, because that would have broken their spirit, so he's got to get them ready for that. And then once it happens, once Jerusalem's destroyed, he's got to lift them back up and give them hope. Give them hope and encouragement to go back to Jerusalem so that they can rebuild the destroyed city from Nebuchadnezzar and fulfill their purpose. Because what was their purpose? Why had God set them aside as a nation? To bring forth the Messiah. That's right. And so Ezekiel is encouraging this group here to where they would eventually go back as well in about three waves to Jerusalem and rebuild the city there. And again, that's where the capital of Babylon was. This is just a statue from that era of a Mesopotamian ruler. This is their chief deity, Marduk. Now, in the city of Babylon was the temple of Marduk. And Nebuchadnezzar was known for a lot of his building projects as well. In fact, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world was actually located in Babylon. What was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world? The Hanging Gardens or Terraced Gardens of Babylon. That's right. That was one of those. This is an artist's conception of maybe what Babylon kind of was laid out like in Daniel's time. The river Euphrates flowed between it. You had the older city right here, the newer city right there. Now, some historians say that the city walls themselves were over 50 miles long, and the walls were 300 feet tall. Now, that's probably an exaggeration. Herodotus is the one that said that. That's a bit of an exaggeration. They really think probably the walls were more like 10 miles long and about 80 feet tall. But still, very, very impressive structure at that time. Another artist's conception of maybe what it looked, there was a canal that completely surrounded the city. Again, the Euphrates flowed through it. And here were two temples. You have the temple center and the temple of Marduk that were located there. And then you also had a very impressive gate called the Gate of Ishtar. Now, the British got the remains of Ishtar and took it to the British National Museum, and that's where the Gate of Ishtar now stands, is in one of the British museums. But this is the reconstruction of the Gate of Ishtar, very impressive as you were entering the city, and in fact inscribed on it. They found that Nebuchadnezzar had actually placed this on that gate. He says, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, laid the foundation of the gates down to the ground water level and had them built out of pure blue stone. Upon the walls in the inner room of the gate are bulls and dragons, and thus I magnificently adorned them with luxurious splendor for all mankind to behold in awe." And that kind of sounds like him in chapter 4, doesn't it? When he's getting a little arrogant and proud of himself, and has a dream about this magnificent tree, and the tree then is leveled, and Daniel has to tell him, "That's you, and you're about to be humbled because you've gotten too proud and arrogant, and you think that all of these things that you see before you are the result of your own hands and your own strength and power, and you've forgotten that God's the one that's placed you in this position." And so you kind of get the idea. He's taking credit for a lot of these things. And then concerning the Tower of Marduk in Babylon, he wrote that the original tower had been built in antiquity. He says, "A former king built the temple of the seven lights of the earth, but he didn't complete its head. Since a remote time, people had abandoned it without order expressing their words. Since that time, earthquakes and lightning had dispersed its sun-dried clay, the bricks of the casing had split, and the earth of the interior had been scattered in heaps." And so he, in his own writings, is talking about this ancient tower that they actually built the Temple of Marduk on top of that. And that is possibly a reference to the Tower of Babel. Can't be for sure about that, but interesting nonetheless when they found this inscription on one of the cuneiform tablets from Babylon. This is one artist's conception of maybe what the temple might have looked like. A common structure would have been this kind of a terraced ziggurat, is what they call it. This is actually one that was in ruins in Ur. It has since been restored. I've seen some of these ancient structures, not over in the Middle East, not in Iran, not in the Fertile Crescent. I was down in Peru in 2007 and was traveling to a city with one of the brethren named Javier, or Chicho. We all call him Chicho. And I see a sign that talks about an archaeological site that's 10 kilometers up the road. And I asked Chicho, I said, "What is that?" He says, "I don't know, but we have time to go see it." And so we went to see this structure. And in the 90s, they actually, one of the archaeologists in Peru, was looking out over this valley. And all of these structures, there were a bunch of sand mountains or dunes, but they didn't look completely natural. And she began to wonder, what's under this sand? She began to uncover it, and they located so far at least 19 of these structures, these terraced temples. And what's interesting about them, the guy that was taking us through, and I've since, the British have come over and they've studied it, and they've done a documentary on the ruins of Coral. That's in Coral, Peru. They can't figure out where these people came from. Generally, you can begin to see evidence of primitive structures that graduate to more and more complex structures, but the British concluded it seems like these people just arrived here with all of these building skills and nobody knows where they came from. And then nobody knows where they went, but since that time, this has been kind of a holy site to a lot of civilizations. They would leave offerings around the perimeter of this area, but they kept wondering, you know, where did these people come from? They just seemed to arrive here. They had these building skills of these terraced, large terraced temples and buildings. I told Chicho when we got back in his truck, I said, "Well, I have one idea where that might have come from." And we went to Genesis chapter 11, where it talked about the Tower of Babel and how the Lord scattered them over the face of the earth. And, it's possible that the Lord scattered some of them to South America, and they might have just picked up where they left off with all of these building skills. Who knows for sure? Now, this was a photo from 1913. Showing the ruins of Babylon back then. Now, since then, and this is a little more recent of the ruins of Babylon, but since then, Saddam Hussein tried to rebuild Babylon to make a name for himself. Of course, you know, he toppled in power. But this is some of his work and what he financed to try to, he was going to rebuild Babylon and make a great name for himself. And it didn't last. But concerning the Babylonian Empire now. Now, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream in chapter 2 that talks about some of these world empires. Now, Daniel, when he was carried away in about 606 B.C., that was when the last of the Assyrian army and Pharaoh Necho had been destroyed. But he was probably about 15 to 17 years old at that time. So he would have seen the Assyrian Empire. Then Nebuchadnezzar has a dream of this image. And Daniel interprets the dream for him. And as you recall, the image represented four world empires. The present one, which was what? That was the Babylonian Empire. That's right. And the gold head represented the Babylonian Empire. And then you had a torso of silver, you had thighs of bronze, and then legs of iron and feet of iron and clay. What did the silver torso, what was that? It represented the next major empire, which would have been what? And Daniel saw them come as well. The Medo-Persians, that's right, the Medo-Persian Empire. And then the bronze represented by the next major empire, the Greeks. That's right, the Grecian Empire. And then after the Greeks came what major empire? The Romans. And of course, Daniel interprets the dream in Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, that it's going to be in the days of those kings that God's going to set up a kingdom that's never going to be destroyed. These kingdoms are going to pass away. They're going to blow away like the chaff of wheat. But God's going to establish a kingdom in the days of these kings, the Roman Empire. God's going to establish an everlasting kingdom. And that was one of Daniel's messages about this everlasting kingdom. Ezekiel gives the same message to the Jews at the end of his book. And so the Medo-Persians replaced the Babylonians. And who was the ruler during the Medo-Persian Empire? Who was the first one that conquered and replaced the one that Daniel would have been under? Okay, Darius was the one that was given charge of the Medes, but not the Persians. There was one that was over him, actually. Darius was probably a subject king to a greater king who was Cyrus. Cyrus was the one. In fact, this is one of his statues, and there's an inscription at the base of this where he declares, "I am Cyrus, king of the four corners of the world." So he was the one that controlled that vast empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. And his tomb is located in Iran today. Well, after the Persian Empire, in Macedon, there was a young man that was born in Pella. And who was born in Pella? Alexander the Great. That's right. Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great is the one that actually pushed the Grecian Empire to form. Well, there's a relief of Alexander the Great. He 356 to 323. He pushed the Grecian Empire from here all the way out to India and down through Egypt. And actually, he wanted to establish the capital of the Grecian Empire there in Babylon. But there's a lot of different sources as to say what happened to him. He died at a fairly young age. Some say he contracted a disease in India, went back to Babylon and died. Some say he was poisoned in Babylon. We really don't know exactly what happened to Alexander the Great. But he's the one that expanded the Grecian Empire. After he died, and what's interesting about this is Daniel writes about all this in the latter part of the book of Daniel. Now, most of us are familiar with chapters 1 through 6. But I would encourage you to do a study of chapters 7 through 12. And that's just really interesting because it's those chapters that caused a lot of people, a lot of liberal critics, to say Daniel couldn't have been written during Daniel's lifetime. It had to be written by someone around 150 to 100 B.C., because there's so many prophecies that have so much detail and are so accurate with what's going to happen 300-400 years later that most of the liberal critics say, well, there's no way that Daniel, back somewhere between 606 and 536 BC, wrote the book of Daniel. He couldn't have known all of these details that were going to come to pass hundreds of years later. Yeah, he could if he was an inspired prophet of God. And Jesus called him a prophet. And so that's enough for me. And that to me adds strength to the validity of God's word. That it is absolutely true. Because what proves that a prophet is a prophet? If he says something and it comes to pass, God says, you know that he is my prophet. If he says something and doesn't come to pass, don't be afraid of him and take him out and stone him because he's a false prophet. So this is the Grecian Empire. And then it was divided up between five of his generals in his army. And the two that became the most prominent were the Ptolemies and the Seleucids here. They began to battle between each other in this land and what's right here? Israel, Jerusalem. That was a major battleground for them. So they're going to go back and forth. And Daniel has a lot of prophecies about those battles that are going to take place between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. So it's basically between Syria and Egypt that all of this is going to be going on. And then they fell to Rome in about 146 BC. And then the Roman Empire was established. And then, as Daniel predicted in Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, in the days of those kings, God's going to establish his everlasting kingdom. And of course, that came about in AD 32-33, when the church was established on the day of Pentecost there in Jerusalem. And so that kind of gives you an idea of the empires that are tied in with Daniel. But the main two that you talk about when you talk about the book of Daniel are the Babylonian Empire. That's Nebuchadnezzar. He carried away Daniel into that first captivity. And then the Medo-Persian Empire. And actually, that's what we're going to talk about tonight, because that's where the change takes place. Now, I'm not going to steal the other guy's thunder. So we're not going to talk about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're not going to talk about Belshazzar and his feast. But it was actually after that feast that very night, there was a change and who controlled Babylon. That's when Babylon was defeated, Belshazzar was killed, and it passed on then to the Medo-Persians. So now let's go to Daniel chapter 6. Daniel chapter 6. And we really kind of need to start in chapter 5, verse 31, because that actually belongs to the text of Daniel chapter 6 as well. Daniel means God is my judge, and probably was from a noble family because those were the ones that they would have carried from Jerusalem to be trained in the king's court there in Babylon. Daniel had been ruling, had been one of the advisors since about 606 BC. It fell, they were conquered around 538 BC. So how old is Daniel at this point? 606 to 538. And he was already about 15 to 17 in 606. So we got someone probably in their mid-80s to almost pushing 90. So he's older here. Yeah, a lot of pictures show young Daniel in the lion's den. It was not young Daniel in the lion's den. It's very old Daniel in the lion's den. And so he's probably in his mid-80s, almost maybe approaching 90. We read now in chapter 5, verse 31, after Belshazzar had been killed, said, Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So Darius is a Mede. He's given this kingdom. There's not a whole lot that we know about Darius. We know he was 62 years old. If you go over to chapter 9, verse 1, we know he was the son of Ahasuerus. He was of the lineage of the Medes, and he was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans. Now, the Chaldeans was just that area of Babylon. It wasn't the whole Medo-Persian Empire. So he was just a local king, ruler, so to speak, that was under Cyrus the Great. And so we read that the kingdom was given, or the rule was given, to him. And in verse 1 now, it pleased Darius, chapter 6, verse 1, to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. So you have these, what's a satrap? Do you all have a different word in your translations for satrap? Prince. Prince is one. This was a ruler under, they could be given a very small rule to a fairly large rule. But here was the idea that you set these up throughout the region. Why? Delegate power and authority throughout the region. And so they were responsible for their region. And then overseeing them was what we read in verse 2. Over these, three governors, some translations read presidents there, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, so that the king would suffer no loss. So really, what's their job? Overseers. And what kind of loss would the king suffer? Taxes. I mean, it takes money to run an empire. And so they basically filtered this down to where, you know, you're in charge of getting their taxes here, and then this particular governor is going to oversee so many satraps so that we make sure the revenue is flowing in and the king is not going to receive any loss, because Darius is going to be having to pay tribute to Cyrus as well. So you want to make sure that the funds are flowing. And Daniel had distinguished himself, verse 3, above the governors and satraps, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. And so you have these three presidents or governors, and now King Darius is really impressed with Daniel. I mean, he's got a lot of wisdom. He's got a lot of experience. He's established his reputation already. How honest is he? He is beyond reproach. I mean, he is unimpeachable. His character is everything that it should have been. In fact, Ezekiel refers to him three times and talks about the righteousness, the character of Daniel, and the wisdom of Daniel. So here's a very wise man, a man who has an unimpeachable character. He is being considered by Darius to being placed over everyone. Now, how's that set with the other governors? Not very well. That's right. And so look at verse 4. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge of or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. I mean, they started looking at the books. I mean, if you're going to catch an official, how are you going to catch him? Use a hand in the cookie jar, right? So they start checking the records and checking the books. They can't find anything on Daniel. There's nothing on him. And why is there nothing on him? Because he's faithful. Faithful to whom? Faithful to God. But he was also, you read earlier, he was faithful to Nebuchadnezzar. He had a good relationship with Nebuchadnezzar and influenced Nebuchadnezzar. We don't have time to do this, but you can kind of trace a change that takes place in Nebuchadnezzar through his life. And the same change is going to take place in Darius, where they come to recognize that there is no God that is greater than the God of Daniel. Now, we don't get any indication that they completely left their paganism, but at least they acknowledge God as the God over all gods. So he influenced them. He changed them. He had a good reputation with them. And that's probably why Darius was thinking about appointing him to be over everyone. That didn't set well with them. They tried to find something against him. Couldn't do that. So what are they going to use? They're going to use his faith. They're going to use his religion against him. And see if they can come up with some way, because they know he's faithful. He's faithful to God. He's faithful to the kings. So let's use that faithfulness against him. Sound familiar? Sound familiar in our culture today? Are there those who are targeting those who have faith in God and using their faith against them? We see that happening more and more in our culture today. Yes?
Interesting the way verse 5 puts it concerning the law of his God.
Yes. Yeah. We can't find fault with him and our law, but we know he's faithful to God. So let's see if we can change laws that are going to trap him. Because we know he's not going to go against the law of God. So if we can change our law, we can trap him with his own faith. And we see that strategy in our culture today, folks. That there are those who are actively changing laws that are contrary to the laws of God. And too many courts are ruling. If it comes between your faith and this person's feelings, who's going to lose?
In our courts in this country, we will
lose. Yeah, we will lose. Yeah, a country that was established on freedom of religion is taking that away now. And we best get ready for it. And Daniel's a good lesson for that as to how we need to stand when that starts happening. Because it's frankly accelerated much faster than I thought it ever would. 20 years ago, I would have been worried about my great-great-grandkids. Not anymore. I'm worried about my kids and my grandkids. What kind of a culture are they going to be brought up in? And every time I go down to Peru, I'm looking for some land when I'm going down there. But verse 6. It says that these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom. That's a lie. How many governors were there?
Three.
All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, what's the lie there? What's that? All, that's right. We know at least one that wasn't in on that consultation. And that was Daniel. Because we read here in a little bit that he then learns about the writing being signed. So I don't believe Daniel was in on all of those meetings. They kept him out of those meetings. And used a phrase that is so common today. You know, someone has a pretty weak position. And so they say, well, there are a lot of folks that feel the way I do about this. And don't you hear that sometimes? There are a lot of, or what my kids used to say, well, Dad, everybody's doing this. And I'd go, uh-uh, not buying it. At least one body is not doing this. And that's you. So, yeah, that's common line. We've all met together and everyone has consulted together, and we want you to make this, to sign this decree that no one can petition their God for 30 days. Now, why would Darius sign such a thing? What?
Ego,
vanity, that's right. That sounds pretty good. I mean, I am king after all. So why shouldn't they go through me? And, there's this idea that some of the emperors and rulers felt that they were sons of gods. And so they almost put themselves on the equivalent with the gods. So why not? And I'm not really asking that they completely give up their faith. All just 30 days. They need to go through me if they want to petition any god. And they remind him in verse 8, Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Now, in Babylon, the word of the king was final, and the king could change his mind. Under the Medes and the Persians, not so. Once the decree had been signed, not even the king could go against that decree. And so they dupe him into signing that decree. And so verse 9, therefore King Darius signed the written decree. And we read in verse 10, Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. How long had he been doing this? All of his life. That's right. I mean, his heart was back in Jerusalem. And his heart never left God. His faith was never lost in God. And he continued to pray to God, petition to God. And just because this king had signed this decree, that wasn't going to stop him from doing what he knew he had to do. And that is continue to petition his God, the one true God. And he didn't go and hide when he did it. He didn't change anything. He did it the way he's always done it, with his windows open, facing Jerusalem, praying three times a day. Now, the other governors and satraps that were jealous of him, did they know he was going to do this? Yeah, that's why they set it up. They knew his faith. They knew that he's not going to change. We can't find any indictment against him because of doing anything wrong according to our law. He's going to continue to do what he's always done to his God, and that's how we can catch him. So they got the king to sign the decree, and then they just waited because they knew exactly what Daniel was going to do. Probably knew what time he was going to do it. And so he goes and he prays. And in verse 11, these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? Of course, now whose fault is this when Daniel's caught? I mean, they're trying to put the blame now and the responsibility on the king, and removing it from themselves. And the king answered and said, "The thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter." So they answered and said before the king, "That Daniel..." I think there was a lot of contempt in that. "That Daniel..." They didn't call him Belteshazzar. They used his Hebrew name there. What were they really trying to point out to the king? That foreigner, that guy who serves a strange god, he is in his room petitioning his God. He says, "That Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day." Now Darius kind of realized, oh no, what have I done? Because how did he feel about Daniel? I mean, this all started because of his feelings toward Daniel. How did he feel about Daniel? He trusted him. He's wanting to make him over everyone. And that's what started all the trouble. And so he's grieved at this. You keep reading there in verse 14. "And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself." Now, do you think he was kind of displeased with the ones that duped him? We're going to see that here in a little bit, that he was. He says, "He set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him." So he starts looking for a loophole. Is there any way that we can get Daniel out of this mess? Of course, the law of the Medes and the Persians. He had signed the decree. It can't be changed or altered. Daniel had very obviously violated that decree, and the decree stated, "You're going to be thrown into the den of lions if you do this." And so there's no way that Darius could get him out of that. And just to make sure, and this is where I think they really kind of broke the straw that broke the camel's back as far as the king was concerned. In verse 15, "Then these men approached the king and said to the king, 'Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed.'" Now, he knew that. He had already been laboring all day long to try to find a way out for Daniel. And really what they're doing is they're digging their own graves. They're putting the nails in their own coffin by pushing the king in this. But they want to remind him, because what's in their heart? Envy, jealousy, the green-eyed monsters got a hold of them. And they're really not thinking very clearly as far as what are going to be the consequences after we've gotten rid of Daniel. They're not thinking about that. They've displeased the king greatly in what they've done. He realizes he's been tricked by them. And there's going to be a day of reckoning. First, though, he's trying to see if he can rescue Daniel in any way. Can't find a way out. They then, again, remind and irritate him about that. And so verse 16, the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." Now that really is more a kind of a hopeful wish. I don't think the king really had faith in God yet. He had faith in Daniel's faith. But how well did he sleep that night? He didn't. That's right. And so he's really not sure that God's going to deliver Daniel. Now, he may have heard about the incident with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He may have heard about Daniel's special relationship with God and his ability to interpret the dreams. But he really hasn't witnessed firsthand the power of God yet. And so he's just hoping your God's going to deliver you. Well, verse 17, a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, then that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Now, that probably was a twofold protection. I mean, that protects, really, Daniel from foul play. Because what if one of them comes along and realizes the lions aren't killing him? What would they likely do? Kill him, make sure he's finished, and then blame it on the lions. And so really, that's an extra protection for Daniel from his enemies. How well do you think Daniel slept that night? I mean, we really don't know. Yeah, well, he did have faith. And so I guess that he probably laid down and rested all right. And you know, it's later stated that he states that God sent his angel and stopped the mouths of the lions. Yes?
Maybe initially, Daniel was the same as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that he knew God had the power to, but whether or not he did stop it, he was God.
Because, you know, Christians are...
anxieties and stuff, I don't think you'd be very anxious about it.
Christians aren't guaranteed deliverance from every persecution. A lot of Christians have died. A lot of God's people have died. But really, you stop and think about it. When God's people die... now, the world's way of thinking is, that's the worst thing that could happen to them. But, you know, in Fox's Book of Martyrs, it's mentioned that the Christians, when they went out into the arena to be torn apart by animals... at least some of them, what were they doing? Praying and singing hymns. And the Romans just couldn't believe. Why are these? They're about to be torn apart by animals. Why are they singing these hymns? Because of their faith in God. And they knew that, you know, most likely God was not going to deliver them because they'd already seen probably other brothers and sisters be put to death in all kinds of different ways. But they knew as soon as my life ends here, I go to a much better place. And I have a relationship with God, no pain, no sorrow, no tears, no hunger, no thirst. And that's the faith of God's people. But he seals Daniel in. Now, verse 18. The king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought before him. Also, his sleep went from him. Didn't spend a very good night resting. And the next morning, gets up early, verse 19, he rose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice or a grieved voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you serve continually been able to deliver you from the lions?" So is he sure yet? I mean, he's saying this with grief. You get the idea? He's pretty sure Daniel's been a midnight snack for the lions. And he's just hoping against hope that he's going to hear something. And Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever." That's a typical greeting in that time. "My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you." He said, I didn't do any wrong. And I have done what I've always done. God comes first. My service to God comes first. I have done no wrong. Now, how could he say that when he broke the law? That's right. Man did not have the right to make that law. And when men make laws contrary to the law of God, as the people of God, do we do wrong? If we break those laws and favor serving God rather than men? No, we do not. Now, we may do something contrary to man's law. And we may suffer the consequences of doing something contrary to man's law. We may be fined heavily. We may lose our business. We may lose our homes. We may be jailed for that. Yes.
One of the things about Daniel and the people who were taken into captivity is that they were instructed through God's prophet to pray for the king, to pray for that kingdom, with the assurance that when it goes well with them, it goes well with you. And it is conceivable that in Daniel's prayer 3 times a day, he was praying for the welfare of the king that he served, of the,
yeah,
the nation in which he lived. And so he had done no wrong, even by God's law.
Yeah.
To say you can't petition any god was an unrighteous law to begin with, but in his petition, he was praying for the welfare of the king.
And he wanted that. He wanted the welfare of Nebuchadnezzar. He wanted the welfare of Darius. He wanted what was best for these world empires because God's people were living in the midst of them. And like you said, if it goes well with the empire, it goes well with them as well. And so Daniel was delivered. God had sent an angel, shut the lion's mouths. And so the king then in verse 23, the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den and no injury whatever was found on him because he believed in his God. Now, he didn't have a guarantee that that would happen, but God chose to deliver him. Why? There's a phrase that's used in Ezekiel throughout the book of Ezekiel. Why is God allowing these things to happen? So that they might know I am the Lord. That's why I'm doing these things. That's why I'm demonstrating my power. So that they will know that I am the Lord. That's why God delivered Daniel. That's why he delivered Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So that they would know, so Nebuchadnezzar would know, so Darius would know, I am the Lord. And our message goes out to those around us when we have faith in God and we refuse to compromise our convictions, that we stand for what's right regardless of what we might be threatened with. And I believe a time in our country is coming. Maybe the tide will turn. I don't see that historically happening that often. But we may reach a point where us in this audience tonight, not just our kids, our grandkids, but we may be persecuted for our faith. And we need to remember the lesson of Daniel, that we stand firm, we believe in God, we're going to do what God wants us to do regardless of what men may say or threaten to do to us. And verse 24, the king gave the command and they brought those men who had accused Daniel and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children and their wives. And the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. And that again showed that the lions, you know, the king hadn't fed them just before they put Daniel in there and they just weren't hungry. I mean, that demonstrated that had God not intervened, the same fate would have awaited Daniel as well. And then look at what King Darius decreed after that. He knew a little more about God. And he said to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, verse 25, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God. What's the idea there? The living God. I mean, you appeal to these stone idols, what results do you get? Nothing. They're dead stone. They're dead wood. There's nothing they can do. This God is a living and active God. He's acted, and he's acted in such a way that there's no doubt that there was supernatural power behind what went on in that lion's den. And so he calls him the living God, steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. Now, maybe this is a reference. He was familiar with Daniel's earlier prophecy that he made in Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, of God establishing a kingdom which will last forever. And his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. And God's able to do the same for us today. Now, it might not be deliverance by getting your house back, getting your accounts back, by getting your business back, or even by lengthening the days of your life. Might not be that kind of deliverance. Is it a deliverance, though, if we are put to death for our faith? That is absolutely a deliverance, if we're put to death for our faith. Now, again, these are pretty strong words to be using, and I really wouldn't have been speaking them with that much conviction 20 or 30 years ago. But I see changes. And Lance preaches with me at King's Ridge. We've had quite a few conversations. We need to be getting God's people ready for what's coming, to where they will stand fast when the test of faith comes. If the trials increase, if things get worse, we need to be getting ready for that. Now, let's pray it doesn't happen. Let's continue to pray that God can work things through His providence so that we don't face further persecution. But if not, let's have the faith of Daniel. Yes, sir.
In this decree that the king made, you see from the previous decree that was made, that even the king was not above the law.
No.
That he made.
That's right.
And in that he binds this to fear and tremble before God.
Including himself.
Himself to fear and tremble before God. Raises the question, would Nebuchadnezzar, who came through faith and tremble of God, be in heaven? Will this one be in heaven?
We don't know.
Yeah. Principle, yeah. That God was always looking for is those that were fearing Him before Him. Mm-hmm. And he's in this category of faith.
Yeah.
Fearing and trembling before God.
Yeah. Yeah. We hope that they came to that point, but again, I'm not going to whittle on God's end of the stick. So we'll leave that in the hands of God. Thank you all very much.